Welcome to the Vocation of the Common Good podcast. I'm Philip Lourish, your host. Today my guest is Maurice Wallace, Associate Professor in the Department of English and Associate Director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African American and African Studies, also at the University of Virginia. Before coming to UVA, Maurice taught at Duke and Yale University. Throughout his academic career, Maurice has also pastored a historically Black Baptist church in rural North Carolina. Here, we'll talk about how a sense of vocation has sustained him within these different worlds. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
My God, where I go, glory. Where I reap and where I sow, glory. And my hands, they grip the thorns, glory. In the still.
You have one vocation and two jobs. Is that the way you would say it?
I have a single vocation, two jobs. They don't always feel like the same vocation, and they don't always feel like two jobs. In the better moments, my serving a congregation and serving my students feels like the same thing. Then, of course, there are times when my life feels like I am, to borrow a phrase from a theologian named Howard Thurman, it feels like my life is at cross purposes. I have lived a very frenetic life on the one hand. On the other hand, I have to say that I have never been more fulfilled in my life than when I have been engaged in both jobs simultaneously. My one job is in Virginia, at University of Virginia, and the other, until very recently, was in North Carolina, teaching college students and pastoring an intimate, mostly African-American church. So yes, you've aptly described the way I have lived my life these past 10 years, at least.
It's been that long.
Yeah, it's been that long. Except to say that for some time I was serving a church and teaching in the same city. It's only been in the last 4 years that I was serving a church in one city and teaching in another.
Did you have students that were also members or attenders of your church?
Interestingly, we had a good number of graduate students who knew me from the classroom, but also were interested in developing their own faith walks. And so without much of anything in the way of explicit invitation by me, they showed up. I think what was very valuable about that experience for them and me was my modeling something that they hadn't seen much of and that some of them actually aspired toward. I did not aspire toward being bivocational. I accepted the invitation to serve, and I did my best to be a good academic. The overlap was really important to me. I hope it was important to them because it also affirmed me. Mm-hmm. Like their presence affirmed something in me that I don't think they ever fully appreciated. Mm-hmm. I hope that my modeling something for them gave them at least some courage to think about serving and being an academic, though I'm not altogether sure I recommend it.
Yeah. How did you come to decide to accept that invitation?
I was a graduate student pursuing a PhD in English literature that I decided upon almost at the same time that I was also considering seminary. It turns out that I chose the academic path without sort of altogether abandoning hopes for seminary. I went to graduate school, found myself in a church that I really cared a lot about, and it was not that church specifically, but a neighbor church that had a pastoral search going, and my pastor at the time recommended me just to serve as a preacher, to be a supply preacher for them. I did that. And so in the last 2 or 3 years of my graduate studies, I found myself also serving a church. Mm-hmm. And it was a very good relationship. And it was only because I finished my PhD and had a job offer elsewhere. This is an interesting story. I stepped down from that position, took my first job at Yale. And while I was teaching there, my wife was enrolled in a public health program. That was a 3-year term. When she finished her program in epidemiology and public health, she was offered a position at Duke Health System, where we'd just come from.
Heading home.
So she accepted their offer, and the church I formerly pastored knew that if she was coming to Durham, I wasn't going to be far behind. So they asked me to resume my pastorate there. And what that allowed for was regular travel from New Haven to Raleigh-Durham so I could see my wife. So it was a nice, you know, a nice deal.
You've been commuting for a while. Yeah.
I have been. So that happened, and I resumed that. And for several years, I dedicated myself to those dual roles.
And was that every weekend?
Yep. At least 2, maybe 3 weekends.
So you were sharing the...
But of course,
you were sharing.
I was married. I wanted to be there every weekend.
Right.
The tougher thing was going back to New Haven. It wasn't getting to Raleigh-Durham.
Yeah, right. So you were sharing the pulpit at that point?
Yes.
Who was on the team?
Well, understand that this was a traditional, rural, African-American, mainline Baptist congregation, which meant it was very family-oriented, that there were probably 4 or 5 big families in the congregation, and those 4 or 5 big families made up about 150 people or more. And in that tradition, your senior pastor is your lead pastor, is your primary teacher, is your Bible study instructor, is your chief executive officer. You're there for hospital visits.
Yeah.
You're there for funerals. You're there for weddings, family reunions, house blessings, all of that. But it was a very important time for relationship building with me and coming to really know community intimately. So I did it all with the exception of maybe 2 or 3 unpaid associates who were looked to fill in things between the major events or the major liturgical matters. So if I was responsible for the preaching or teaching, then someone else would be available to offer the community prayer, or someone else would be able perhaps to do a blessing of a house if I'm not there, or those things that required somewhat less investment of time and energy, but obviously no less important than those other matters that I was responsible for. So I had a little help, but with the exception of the pastor and music leaders, this is entirely volunteer enterprise. So any help I had was by people who, thank goodness that they had it, thank God for them, who felt a sense of vocation of their own. And that sense of vocation compelled them to freely give their time and energy in support of what I was trying to accomplish, as we say, the under shepherd of that flock.
Was there ever any friction there with you being up north in New Haven for the week, you know, absent from the flock?
No. See, there's a history that's worth remembering here that preceded me. And the history depends on remembering that this is a rural congregation, which means that for generations, this church met twice monthly because there were certain Sundays that were designated work days,
right,
as folks who raised tobacco. And it also meant that they shared a pastor with another charge, perhaps 3 miles away. And there were families from one church that married into families at another church. So it was a wide community that sort of understood how important it was to share resources, not the least resource being the pastor preacher. So my congregation was accustomed to a kind of self-pastoral care in the absence of a senior pastor on whom most of those responsibilities have come to fall. So though they would have liked me to be present during the week much more often, they were not unhappy. I think they liked the idea of having a dedicated pastor that was theirs, whom they did not have to share, nor did any of the other churches in the area have to share a pastor by this time. I think they were much more accommodating because I was young at the time and because they knew how to care for one another as community members. And that's a really nice thing to see. The only downside to that dynamic in my mind is when there's a pastoral search, it could take a while. And there's no urgency because so much of what we expect pastors to do, they can do themselves as lay people. Again, it's really a nice thing. But if you are in seminary looking to pastor, you don't want them to wait a long time to decide. Right. You want to know you're going to be employed when you leave seminary.
What do you think would be different if more churches had bivocational pastors?
I don't think that bivocational pastors, generally speaking, I don't think they're going to be effective anymore. I think the clip at which we live our lives is so fast-paced, and that the pastorate has become so nearly professionalized that it's the rare congregation that would not want and expect more, expect full-time attention and service. You know, I think that if there are congregations that are rethinking what it means to be a full-time ministry, then there might be possibilities there. But as far as I can tell, things are moving in the other direction, that churches that have not thought of themselves historically as full-time are actually now trying to fill the weekend with activities, events, worship. And that's not all bad, but it does mean that it's tougher and tougher for someone to be bivocational and give his or her best energies to a church. It's a pastor's best energies, I think, a church desires, has come to expect, and even pastors, I think, want to give. So it's a tough thing, and probably much tougher today than it was even 15, 20 years ago, and it may get even tougher.
Intrigued about what it would feel like and what it would be to deliver sermons as a sort of unique public speech act.
Mm-hmm.
And given your attention to craft, attention to words, attention to different forms of public speech, I'm wondering how you think about preaching, particularly as it relates to other forms of talk you do.
I am certainly my own worst critic, but I have critical sensibilities. And I said that because I have said only half jokingly as an academic that academics make the worst preachers because we're often too given to presentation and therefore also sometimes too self-conscious about the preaching act. I love language, and preaching lets me play a bit with language, lets me relish in language, but that's also risky because one can become so playful, so self-indulgent that you actually alienate the people whose attention you're trying to draw.
You get a little too cute?
It's not even just cuteness. It's sometimes cuteness, but it's also just methodical presentation.
Right.
Right? You want the right introduction. You want, you know, your 3 points. You want a rousing conclusion, and things should be nicely packaged, when to my mind, the best preaching isn't so neatly packaged. It comes from a place that is certainly in one's head to some degree, but really speaks from the gut more so than the head. In my experience, that connects with people. And I think the folks I look at, I see from the pulpit on Sunday mornings, they're looking to be connected to God, but through you. And so the academic style of presentation has been less effective in my own experience. Let me put it that way. And it matters where you are, who your audience is. I get that. But my congregation was not full of academics. Maybe 50% college educated, which is to say, therefore, sort of familiar with a more academic manner of preaching. But then there are those who want something visceral and want to know that these aren't theories, this is experiential. And so that's sometimes a challenge for me, I have to admit, because I'm an academic and I don't apologize for being an academic. I'm an intellectual. I have come to a place where I no longer apologize for that in the context of preaching and pastoring. And I think for me, my relationship with an intimate congregation has afforded me certain flexibilities, which means if I want to make an argument, they'll allow that. Just not every week.
Does it act back? Does that desire or that compulsion to feed the sheep, to sort of speak to them from the word for today, does that act back on academic work or anything else?
It reminds me who I am in the first place, which is to say that the same demographic I described my congregation as constituting was also the demographic of my childhood congregation. And that's the congregation that shaped me. So that coming back, that return is a reminder of who I am. It helps me keep my feet on the ground. But it also shows up academically in this respect, that in their own way, my tribe, they're all theorists. In their own way, they're all critics. If one has an ear bent to hear what the Spirit may be saying through people who are not equally credentialed, right? And I've learned to revere that. In fact, almost envy it. I've met people who are way smarter than I am and spent fewer years in school than I did. Like, why couldn't I have gotten it so easily, right? I was in school as long as I was in school because it just took me that long to learn, right? Whereas there are people I know, friends and members of our congregation and community members, lay people who are brilliant on their feet. So I've learned to test my academic ideas by imagining that those who I sit in front of or stand in front of on a Sunday morning, how they might respond to it, how they might critique it, or even how their lives, in as much as I know them, shape up compared to what I think I am offering by way of knowledge. I often think of myself, frankly, as a translator, right? I've credentialed in a particular way. There's a particular lexicon that's familiar to me now. What I write about may not be things that the average member of my congregation would write in such language. I'm translating it for a new audience. The things I think I know that I'm telling you, they taught me. Just in a language that I know well, I know intimately, and can convey to others. So much of what I do is translation work. That's tough sometimes in this respect, when you have, to use some academic language, competing epistemes.
There we go.
Right? So I may make an academic presentation that is based on theories that my tribe has sort of given voice to in non-theoretical language.
They made it plain.
They made it plain. And it bumps up against sometimes the things that we have been conditioned, socialized, educated into knowing. Or, and this is probably more often the case, that ways of knowing are different, right? I spoke earlier about the desire for the viscerally preached sermon. That experience, that viscerality, is a source of knowledge. You know, we are regularly in our larger society denigrating the value of feeling. Emotion is irrational and therefore cannot be trusted as a source of knowledge, we say. But in fact, I submit that emotions are an intelligence as well. And trusting that need not be always in competition with our sort of reflex to appeal to the rational. And so, again, these are both very fruitful kinds of engagements for me, but sometimes very challenging when there are competing epistemologies. And I sometimes find myself sort of challenging what we all accept, because by way of our post-Enlightenment rational habits of thought, we've just accepted.
Would you say then that critics are more in tune with the gut, that the role of the critic is to pay attention to the ways that those of us that have trained ourselves to outthink our own initial instincts?
You know, I hesitate to describe the critic that way, except I wouldn't hesitate to describe the artist that way. And to the degree that artists are also critics, then yes. So I'm profoundly influenced by James Baldwin's writing, who thought and wrote quite a bit about the sensibilities and sensitivities of artists. He called them poets, but he meant all artists. And I have come to accept that there is a unique aptitude, a capacity in artists. First, if you self-identify as an artist, then you probably are an artist, because I think we live in a historical moment where artists aren't afforded a great deal of the respect that artists deserve. That's likely because, if I follow James Baldwin's thought, artists at their best are disturbers of the peace. And so disturbers of the peace, disturbers of the status quo, are not always esteemed.
They're not always institutionally not savvy.
Exactly. I think this is why artists are so important to us. I think that the artist's relationship to his or her society is nearly unique, and that at their best, artists are preachers and prophets. Baldwin certainly was. No one would dispute that he wasn't, in fact, both of those things. And biographically speaking, from the age of 14 to 17, he was a preacher in his family Pentecostal church in Harlem, as a matter of fact. I'm very influenced by his thinking about the identity and the vocation of the artist, and the artist as a critic, and the artist as helping us all to see past what is, and to both get to the bottom of and see beyond.
Did he have to be as much of an institutional dissident as he was? I mean, my sense of Baldwin was that there was a certain type of critical distance that he felt compelled to retain.
I think so. But of course, remember that it wasn't altogether voluntary,
right?
He was black, he was poor, he was gay. From a certain point of view, that shaped his critical capacities, right? That sharpened his critical capacities. He embraced then that exile status and assumed a position, a perspective that allowed him to see more clearly, more vividly, more critically the forest, because he wasn't that close to the trees.
Be to God, the maker.
So in 1965, James Baldwin debated William F. Buckley in the Cambridge Union on the question of whether the American dream is at the cost of the American Negro. I assume you've seen the footage. The most amazing moment to me was, you know, Baldwin does his thing. Buckley gets up there and accuses James Baldwin of putting on an English accent.
Yeah.
and it cuts to Baldwin, and you see his eyes jump up.
Yeah.
That guy is accusing me of being an imposter.
Yeah, yeah.
And is really poignant for me, not knowing nearly as much about Baldwin as you do, but it was this moment of a certain type of both cementing of a dissident status. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of you Cambridge white guys, nor mm-hmm. am I from the New York that William F. Buckley right. lives in.
And there's nothing in his speech
right.
that would hint that he was seeking membership.
Not at all. Not at all.
Right. So that makes it all the more remarkable. The other thing that's remarkable about that speech, I have to say, is that speech, as it were, is collected in the Library of America's volume of James Baldwin essays. It is edited by Toni Morrison. It is included in the volume verbatim, which is to say he was speaking essay.
Right.
That's a remarkable thing. There's very little of the in-between ahs and ums and hmms, and there is clear thoughtfulness going on. But I've always been astonished, and again, this may also speak to the earlier question you put to me about being an academic and preaching, that he could speak apparently without notes in such a way that one only has to transcribe the words and you have a publishable essay. How remarkable is that? To say nothing of the content, right? The content itself is remarkable. And clearly, to the degree that anyone would see Baldwin and Buckley as in some sort of competition, and those students, of course, did, the nod went to Baldwin.
Of course. And he brought the house down.
Yeah, he did. He did.
The criticism from William F. Buckley mm-hmm. that somehow this man is not authentic,
mm-hmm.
this man is a fraud, felt so cheap
yeah.
and so surprising to Baldwin in that moment that it feels like it's bigger than just that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. One wonders if, in fact, Buckley imagined that Baldwin was an imposter because surely no one born with the sort of deficits Baldwin was born with could be serious and as responsible, accountable, learned in his words as this guy is. And yeah, he sort of pulls the rug out from under Buckley before Buckley even gets to stand up. And, you know, one wonders what he was expecting. That's the other thing. Like, could Baldwin's surprise be the surprise of who did you think I was?
Yeah, right.
And ironically, Baldwin had titled essays and books after this phenomenon of misrecognition. Nobody Knows My Name. It's a title of a long essay. No Name in the Street is another one. And this feeling of either invisibility or misrecognition may well have been dramatized in that moment. That,
right.
that cutaway represents a thing that Baldwin knows about himself or others' perception of him regrets and yet can't escape it. Like, Buckley doesn't know my name.
That's really powerful, and that's something that I've been thinking a lot about in terms of the power of naming, the power mm-hmm. of language to not create a world, but name a world rightly.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that's part of what preaching is. It seems yeah. to me that's part of what academic work is. It's part of what human work is. We're naming.
Yeah. Preaching is all the more challenging for anyone because we're called upon to name the world in a limited space of time with the attention afforded us by the people in front of us being limited as well. That's a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hard thing to have language at hand. It's a hard thing to paint a picture on the clock, which is not an appeal for longer preaching time, so much as it is to point to the ways in which, as beautiful and powerful as language can be, there are totalizing influences in our everyday lives that make that responsibility all the more challenging. And so it goes back to your question about bivocationality mm-hmm. and the challenge of it. if your time is already purchased by another employer, then that's time that's not spent trying to name the world we inhabit. Give voice to experience, whether that experience be joyful or mournful. It's just not a lot of time to connect, to facilitate connection with Earth and the divine.
Vocation in the Common Good is a production of New City Commons and the Narrativo Group. This episode was produced by Mike Cosper and Philip Lorish. It was edited by TJ Hester, and it was mixed by Mark Owens. Rain, it pours and beats the ground.